Each weekday, a member of the community is invited to Coffee at KYUK to discuss news and information relevant to Bethel and the Kuskokwim Delta. Sometimes light, sometimes serious, Coffee at KYUK is where our community connects.
Good day. Good day, good day. This is Grady Deaton. I'm here in the studio with Petra Harpik, and we're so happy to bring you Coffee at KYUK. We're sitting down with Christine Soule. She's a wildlife biologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and I'm happy to have her here in the studio this morning. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning.
Christine, you've been a wildlife biologist your entire professional career.
Yes, that's correct.
And you're from Alaska. You're Alaskan tried and true is what
yes.
I say.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your experience with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, just to give us our listeners a little bio.
Well, my first experience with Fish and Wildlife was when I was in college. I was going to school at UAF up in Fairbanks, and I took a summer volunteer job on Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And at the time, I was a biology student, but I liked all aspects of biology. I could have just as easily become gone into genetics or something like that. And I took this field job up in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and I was hooked, and I became a field biologist instead and have worked for wildlife refuges ever since.
Well, you just got back from a shorebird festival, and before the show we were talking, and you had some interesting information relative to the geographic connection between migratory birds, and I wanted to have you expound a little bit on that to our listeners, because you mentioned some important stuff.
Yeah. Well, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta is we're a globally important breeding area for shorebirds in particular. And, of course, everybody knows our waterfowl. And our birds go on all the different flyways in the Americas. So at the Shorebird Festival, I was talking about the Western Sandpiper, and that's a species that the majority of them breed here, and they go down as far south as northern South America, like Peru and Venezuela.
You know, I forgot, because I know that Petra Harpik was real excited about you coming in today. She had a few comments and some questions she'd like to ask you herself. Petra, what do you
want? Welcome to the show, Christine.
No, thank you.
This morning, as we were getting ready for the day, my son looked out the window and he said, "Look, Mom, there's a swallow." So I ran to the window and I'm like, that's my favorite bird.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorites too. I had the first report of a swallow the day before yesterday. And then I was out yesterday checking on boxes that we have for this program, and was seeing swallows everywhere. And so even on the drive to work today, I saw a pair of tree swallows sitting on top of a box.
You know, you mentioned that project. I'm excited about that project. That's a citizen science project that I believe that Fish and Wildlife is conducting for swallow boxes. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, we're instituting. Last year was sort of a pilot year for us, and so this year we're trying to expand a little. We have a citizen science project where right now we have about 32 boxes, but we're hoping to at least increase it to 50, that we monitor during the summer, and we're looking at things like timing of nesting events and nesting success. And this is part of a statewide network. There are also tree swallow monitoring projects. I think there's one at Ruby, Fairbanks, Anchorage, somewhere out on Glen Allen area. And so we're all collecting information on tree swallows.
So let me spell it out for our listeners, though. If they want to be involved in this citizen mm-hmm. science project, they can contact Fish and Wildlife to get a swallow box and some training?
Yes, we have the 4-H built us, I think, 30 tree swallow boxes. And we are willing to hand them out to people for free as long as they're willing for us to collect data on their swallows. Now, you have two options. Either you just host a box and we come out and do the monitoring for you, or you can have training and monitor your own box.
All right, we'll get that number to people in a minute. I just want to segue off to Brett Gibbons. I really respect his time. He's in McGrath. He's a wildlife trooper. He's been in the air either this morning or yesterday. He's got updates about the river up near McGrath. Brett, thank you for joining us yesterday, and thank you for joining us today. What do you know?
Good morning. I flew last about probably 10:30 last night, because we had a lot of movement up here in McGrath. The ice in front of town had finally gone all the way out, and so we had some voids, and the local ice tripod, they kind of do a little mini ice classic deal, that went out yesterday morning here. What was happening is sections of several miles at a time of this ice up here were moving around, and they'd briefly jam up, and then they were actually crumbling and going under the other hard ice. So we had probably a 5-6 mile stretch right here around McGrath that was pretty well cleaned out, and downriver from us near what's called Sterling Landing, the ice was still fast in big sheets, but this other ice is just going underneath it. So I think we've got a pretty safe scenario as far as, you know, the ice thickness and the integrity. It's basically just tearing itself up. So that's kind of what we have, and with that, our water levels never made it all the way over the high banks. We came right up close to some of them when it jammed up here. Some of the normal willow bars are flooded and things like that. But that's what we've got, is it's pretty turning into sort of a non-event since we didn't have hot temperatures and we didn't get a big giant water push. It's just kind of pretty mellow, and I suspect the rest of the ice, there's so about 3-4 miles above town, It was, the old ice is still there from there up to the mouth of what's known as Big River coming in. But that stuff looked terrible. I expect it to just turn loose and come on through today, probably with really very little fanfare.
Well, Brett, I do gather that the breakup this season has been quite uneventful. But what would we still warn ourselves, especially newcomers like myself, to the area? What would we still want to take very precautions with traveling, et cetera? Or, you know, what would we tell our listeners?
A couple things. I mean, one is there's going to be a lot of for boat travelers. We want to keep in mind all the logs that are come down. Everybody downriver is always excited when they get batches of logs from up here to come down for firewood. So that's a good thing. But if you're running in low light or rainy conditions, some of those half-submerged logs are pretty tough to see, and there's going to be a lot of that. There's also going to be a lot, for the next week or more on the lower river, there will be a lot of that, what they call black ice, which would be attached shore ice that's full of dirt and everything, but it's really hard, compact ice, and it stays mostly submerged. You can barely see it, and so that's a travel hazard as far as hitting it and damaging your motor or anything like that. And beyond that, about the next thing is, like I was saying yesterday, there, because of all the snow that still exists up here, as soon as it gets hot out over the next couple of weeks, there's definitely going to be a pretty big surge of water here at some point. Not necessarily a travel hazard, but kind of for people where their boats are tied up or this or that. I mean, at least for us, it raises so fast here that you go from having your boat normally tied up one day to having your boat up sideways in the trees the next day, and it's equally fast up here. So when our stuff is stranded high and dry, makes it, you're checking on your boat 3 or 4 times a day up here as opposed to, once every day or two from the middle river down.
Constant vigilance. Christine is really liking the information you're giving us from up that way, and we are really happy that you were able to join us yesterday and today, and I want to thank you for that. Also, thanking people like Mark Leary, who might be listening. He's intimately aware of the safety concerns with logging. Maybe we can get him in on a future show to talk about that aspect of subsistence lifestyle that we're monitoring as we go forward. I want to thank you again, Brett, for joining us. I want to talk about a couple more things that are going on around here in Bethel with Fish and Wildlife. Thank you for joining us. So, Christine, just real quick, I noticed that we were talking earlier about it being the year of the bird. That's the 100th anniversary of, and you're going to correct me, it's a Migratory Bird Treaty Act in between different nations, right?
Yes. Back in the, it would have been 1918, the U.S. signed a treaty with Great Britain, who was acting for Canada, for the protection of migratory birds. And this was because at this time in our history, we had unregulated what they call market hunting of birds, which was meaning hunting birds for commercial purposes, selling them to restaurants and things like that. And also it was fashionable for women to decorate their hats with, and they all wore hats, with bird feathers. And so they were actually sending birds to the brink of extinction just to decorate their hats. Mm. And so the United, you know, a lot of people said, we don't want to lose our birds. And so the U.S. signed this treaty with Canada. Since then, we have signed additional treaties with Canada, Japan, Russia, and Mexico. And it's all for promoting conservation of migratory birds.
Now, the treaty has some provisions which protect subsistence hunting. Is that right?
Well, yeah. When it was originally signed, you were not allowed to what they call take, which is a very general term for broad categories things. It included hunting, harassing, destroying nests. Anyway, these various things that would impact the birds unless there were, you know, hunting seasons and regulations and stuff like that. But of course, through the ignorance of the governments at the time, they didn't put any provisions in place for indigenous people who normally harvest birds at times that are not traditional sport hunting times. And so I can't remember the year off the top of my head, but I think it was in the early 2000s, they passed an amendment to the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that now allows subsistence harvests by indigenous people to happen legally. Mm. And so that's why we have waterfowl hunting and other types of hunting that happen in the spring.
So this Year of the Bird includes a day. Saturday is World Migratory Bird Day. Is that right?
Yeah. Actually, World Migratory Bird Day has been around a lot longer than just this year.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. It was established in it actually started out as International Migratory Bird Day. It was just for the Western Hemisphere, and it was established by the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Section. And it was to promote conservation of migratory birds and to it was an educational campaign. And so this year is the first year that the International Migratory Bird Day became World Migratory Bird Day, which means now it's not just Western Hemisphere. It's the entire globe that celebrates migratory birds.
But we're going to celebrate it. We're going to celebrate this Saturday with you. You told me you have hot chocolate and cookies, but that's all part of a bird walk. Is that right?
Yes. Patrick Snow, our park ranger, and I will be leading a bird walk, which is to take people out to look for and identify birds. And we'll be meeting at the Fish and Wildlife Office at 10 o'clock, and it's designed to be about 2 hours, and it's for all ages, so families are welcome.
So that's at 10 a.m. this Saturday, from Saturday, 10 a.m. till noon. That's at the Fish and Wildlife Office. It's right on the bend of Eddie Hoffman Highway
before
you get to the Cultural Center or to the hospital, depending which way you're going. Great. I didn't necessarily catch everything that I wanted to catch, but I'm excited that people will get out there and do that bird walk. I hope you have lots of attendees. What do you guys expect to see out there by H. Marker Lake?
Well, the water birds are just arriving. Of course, some of the ducks have been here for a couple weeks now, but the grebes have just showed up and are doing courtship behavior. The Arctic terns have just showed up, so we hope to see some of those. Scops are the diving ducks, which are a little bit later than what we call the dabbling ducks, which are mallards and pintails, and tend to, you know, feed in smaller ponds. But we're also hoping for some shorebirds.
Spectacular. You know, I saw a message came in, and Petra wants to let our listeners hear about it. Go ahead, Petra.
I received a text message from Peter Achak this morning. A nice jam is holding around the gas station. The water level has been steady since yesterday. The ice jam might be holding above the old airport above Akgatjok, in that the jam is releasing below the gas station. I believe that's in Akgatjok.
Thanks for that update, Peter. We really rely on the updates from our friends and other reporters out there. Peter Achak is one of our hosts and also an active volunteer with Search and Rescue, and we really thank for that update. Christine, what's the number to contact if someone wants information relative to any of the things we've mentioned? Those are the Citizen Science Project with the Swallow Count and also the Bird Walk that's taking place Saturday.
Patrick Snow is the point of contact, and his phone number is 543-1004.
543 1004 for Patrick Snow at Fish and Wildlife relative to the swallow count. That's a citizen science project. Also, you guys have that bird walk coming up. So I wish I could join you. I'm otherwise engaged on Saturday from 10 to noon. What do you think? Will you guys be walking all? What is your route that day?
Well, because we're trying to make it for all ages, we don't want to walk very much, which is kind of why we chose our location, because we'll have H Marker Lake there. There's other ponds. There's marsh. We have a nice road to walk on. We picked what we could do in a short distance, say maybe quarter of a mile at most, and get what we think is a good variety of birds.
Spectacular. The key takeaway there that I heard is all ages. So I can expect it, if as long as I'm with a parent, I can bring children as young
yes.
as five even.
Yes, children are welcome. I mean, this is how my dad took me bird watching when I was a kid. This is how you grow up having an appreciation for birds. Either you're spending time in bird habitats and watching birds. I think that's part of a good hunter too. They know their bird habits. So I think just going out and watching birds is a way to develop appreciation for them.
Yeah, I used to. I was afforded the great privilege of working for a conservation group. We used to. One of our mottos was conservation through education, mm-hmm. and indeed, planting the seeds of stewardship amongst our youth is an important mission.
And
I know that's part of yours.
Yeah, and that's one of the objectives of our Tree Swallow project. Is we want it's a way for us to help teach people about birds and bird conservation.
Well, I was marking the days on my migratory bird calendar. I was real lucky to be one of the judges on the migratory bird calendar for next year. I love all that artwork from the kiddos. Kiddos can start working on that artwork throughout the year, I believe, and art teachers throughout the state submit artwork to Fish and Wildlife. I'm going to probably say goodbye to our listeners. Christine, it's been a real pleasure sitting here and talking with you, and I hope that the walk on Saturday is excellent.
All right, thank you.
Don't forget, there's hot chocolate and cookies on that walk, and you've been listening to Coffee at KYUK, where Petra Harpick and myself, Grady Deaton, invite members of the community to talk about issues and information relative to you and our neighbors in the Kuskokwim Delta. Don't forget to be awesome to each other. We'll be right back.